from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The High Technology Foundation, headquartered at the I-79 Technology Park in Fairmont. Online at WVHTF.org.
At the legislature today, high drama in the House as tempers flare over the repeal of a bill regarding alternative fuels and renewable energy, even though the bill passed overwhelmingly. Pro-choice advocates rallied the Capitol today over a newly introduced bill to restrict abortions in West Virginia. And we'll talk about the state's public education system with the president of the West Virginia Board of Education on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Emotions were high in the House chamber today as House Bill 2001 was on its third reading and up for a vote. Liz McCormick reports.
Fireworks went off in the House chamber today as delegates discussed whether or not to pass House Bill 2001. By the end, more than half of the Democrats chose to support the bill, but not all of them agreed quietly.
Let's be clear, this is not a Democrat or a Republican agenda. This is not a labor or an industry issue. This is about the West Virginia coal miner. Sometimes we forget that when we debate these issues. This is about the West Virginia coal miner. So today I rise in support of this bill in hopes that we might get some coal miners back to work.
Delegate Justin Markham, like many of the other Democrats, stood to support House Bill 2001, which would repeal the Alternative and Renewable Energy Portfolio Act, giving more power back to miners and the coal industry. If passed, utility companies would no longer be required to make 25% of their energy come from renewable energy sources like solar or wind. This would instead put all the energy output back on coal, potentially creating more jobs and bring more money back in the state. Delegate Joshua Nelson brought into perspective the jobs lost since the House Bill 103 was passed in 2009, the bill originally behind making the rule.
Since 2012, six plants have shut down, partially due to anticipation from, increased scrutiny from bills like this and from the EPA and the anti-coal miner climate that exists in Washington, D.C. From 2011 to 2014, we have lost 7,000 coal jobs in the state of West Virginia, and that is completely unacceptable and almost solely due to market manipulation.
But tensions arose when Delegate Nancy Guthrie stood to call out those in favor of the bill, saying it was a step backward for the state.
What I can't understand is why this body that wants to make a name for itself, that wants to move this state forward, isn't embracing every possible energy source at our fingertips. In the Eastern Panhandle, we have geothermal that we could be tapping into. We have an abundant supply of water. People who are using solar, our municipalities included, are saving on their energy costs. And a lot of those municipalities were hard-pressed to pay the light bill. Customers are saving money because they have incorporated solar into their portfolio and are selling back. So rates are coming down for those folks who are smart enough to get away from just one source. We need coal, but market forces don't have anything to do with what has been advanced so far. We are going to wear coal around our neck like a yoke that will drag all of us down.
Republican delegates were outraged and deeply offended by Guthrie's statements.
We're talking about this black rock right here. The gentlelady from Kanawha County said that this is a yoke hanging around the neck of West Virginia. But beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and this is made of carbon, and there's something else made out of carbon, and that's diamonds. I see this as the diamond necklace hanging around the neck of West Virginia.
Delegate Randy Smith stood to fight back against anyone opposed to repealing the bill. He said that after the bill was passed 6 years ago, then-Governor Joe Manchin took it to Washington to show it off.
What did that say to the coal miners in the state of West Virginia? What did that tell us, me, my colleagues here? There's a lot of us here that are retired coal miners or laid off coal miners as went into different fields. What did this bill say to us coal miners? Did it say, we're behind you, we got your back? No, that's not what it said. It said, we're on your side, Mr. President. But I can tell you one thing right now, I'm not on his side, and I'm glad that a lot of you have woke up and seen just what this is worth. It's a slap in the face to us coal miners.
Delegate Tim Manchin stood to say he supported the bill to repeal, but brought up yesterday's amendments that were rejected.
And so I am going to vote for this act. But I do want to point out that yesterday we had an opportunity in this room to prove something. We had an opportunity to take up an amendment that would have required an economic impact study so that those people would learn in 2 to 5 years whether the promises they had been made were faithful promises and whether they were kept.
Delegate John Schott was one of the last to speak. He spoke on both sides, saying this bill would not hold the state down.
A lot was mentioned earlier about our failure to diversify. Folks, if we pass this bill, there's nobody going to put handcuffs on us and say you can't diversify. We will diversify as the market allows, and we can protect our folks, especially our disabled, our elderly, those who are on fixed incomes, without burdening them with an unneeded expense that the restrictions, the mandates of this act now put on them.
House Bill 2001 was passed 95-4. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
The Senate passed its version of the repeal of the Alternative and Renewable Energy Portfolio, Senate Bill 1, earlier this week. That bill will now be considered by the House, and the House bill will be considered by the Senate. Coming up, we'll talk about education issues with the president of the State Board of Education. First, here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the Senate today.
Among the bills introduced in the Senate today, Senate Bill 282, to expand the number of member counties in the National Coal Heritage Area Authority to include Lincoln and portions of Kanawha County. The authority assists with state and federal historic preservation, economic development, and tourism projects in the heritage area. Senate Bill 283, to simplify the process by which a bank may adjust the hours of operation for branch offices. Up for passage in the Senate tomorrow, Senate Bill 12, relating to when employees who were fired or have resigned are due their outstanding wages. On second reading, Senate Bill 43, to limit the tolling of the statute of limitations with regard to third-party complaints within a civil action to be filed within a reasonable time. This pertains to time limits within which a criminal defendant can be prosecuted.
Change is not a new thing for the West Virginia Board of Education. Over the past 2.5 years, the state has gone through 3 superintendents, and earlier this week, Governor Tomlin appointed 2 new members to the body. But will the change in legislative leadership be an easy transition for those at the helm of the state's public education system? Here to discuss that relationship and more, State Board of Education President Gail Manchin. President Manchin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with that relationship. How is it going so far between the board and the new Republican leaders?
It's been a very exciting time, actually. We have really appreciated how both the House and the Senate, particularly in education, have reached out to both the state board and to our new state superintendent. So we've had the opportunity to go over, and basically what they asked us to do was to explain an overview of sort of our role, what we're doing, what we've been doing, and also then how that is different from what the state superintendent and the role of the Department of Education. So we have been very impressed that they want us to come and share this information with them, that they're sharing information with us. They're not hesitating to ask questions, and we are sending them the information over. So far, it's been very nice, very workable, and we hope that continues throughout the session.
A day or two before the first day of the session, I spoke with the House Speaker, Tim Armstead, and he said he was concerned at this point that there is too much centralization and too much power within the state board itself. How do you feel about that? Do you think there's any overreach from the state board?
You know, the state board develops policy, and then the Department of Education implements that policy down to the county and then to the local school. I don't believe that we are overreaching. We are mandated by the Constitution to provide free public education to all children in West Virginia. And we take that mandate very seriously. But no, I don't believe we're overreaching. I think because topics become topics in the media, that what may appear to be something that's being run at the state is not. It's developed at the state, but it's the county and our local schools that are implementing and actually reaching out and touching the children every day.
Do you think maybe that impression comes from the fact that this board has taken a stronger role than previous boards?
Oh, I think you're exactly right, Ashton. I think the fact that we have become more accountable and more responsible for the work that we have before us has, yes, I think we're seen differently and we're seen more.
So the speaker also said during that interview that he was concerned with the progress of the education audit. That audit was done by an outside agency and returned to you all in 2012. Can you give us an update? Where do you all stand with those recommendations that you were given?
You know, personally, I can speak only for the board, but the board really appreciated the audit. We believe that it really laid out in a very easy to read blueprint sort of where we were, what had happened over time, and changes that needed to be made. And I think a set of outside eyes looking at any agency is not ever a bad thing, because someone from the outside will see it very differently. Now, maybe not everything totally accurately, not being from the state, but certainly we felt that it was a very good overview, and we took that audit very seriously, read it, and responded to the audit to the governor, which we gave things that we felt certainly that were within our jurisdiction. And we have tried to address those ever since the audit came out. Began addressing them in 2012 and continue. Many of the things we have completed or have reached where the audit felt we should be.
Can you give us an example of one or two of those things that you all have completed?
Well, certainly the department is smaller, and we have taken much more seriously our oversight of the RESAs, what they do and what their responsibilities are, because that was one of the focuses. So the downsizing, the audit, looking at how we can run any of our areas more efficiently is something that we address continuously. And some of the issues were things that would have to be addressed by the legislature.
So some things that you'll be leaning on them to help you with.
Absolutely.
There's one area in particular that Republican lawmakers have been a little bit outspoken on, and that's Common Core. In West Virginia, we call them the next generation standards. Do you all as a board, do you as the board president, still support those standards and that decision you all made in 2010 to adopt them?
Absolutely. Ashton, it is critical that in West Virginia we maintain a high level of standards, high in rigor, and setting that bar for students. Because in the 21st century, the job skills that are needed, the skill sets that students need as they graduate from high school, and of course our goal, our one focus, one voice, all children achieving, that we graduate our students from high school, college, and or career ready. Without these new, much more rigorous standards, we can't do that. Our English standards and our math standards developed by English teachers and math teachers right here in West Virginia agree that these standards encourage children on how to think, not what to think, how to read information critically, how to analyze and evaluate, how to create the questions that need to be asked, and then find the solutions to those problems. A much different learning style than what the former standards, our old standards, we call them the 20th century standards. But for our children to compete, not only here in West Virginia or in this country, but to compete globally, we have to have these very high rigor standards. And unfortunately, the conversation has become one about national standards and national people telling us what to do, and that isn't the case. The case is that the states develop their standards but then align them. Why wouldn't we want to know how we compare with Pennsylvania or Florida or California? Why wouldn't we want to know how our students compare with other students? And more importantly, if you're a parent and have a child and you're living in West Virginia and you're going to move to Michigan or to Minnesota, wouldn't it be nice that when your child goes into that school that they're operating under the same standards, and so your child, the transition from one state to the other becomes so much easier? Now, we are very committed. And one other point that I need to make, if we don't have standards, then everything about our educational system comes to a halt.
So it sounds as if you've had conversations with people who oppose Common Core, and that these are the things you've explained to them, that these are not national outside standards. They're things that we've created for ourselves. Are those the conversations that you're having with lawmakers?
We are having those conversations, and some are much more receptive than others. Some understand now in a different way than they did from what they had heard. We probably didn't do as good a job as we should have done educating our parents and our communities as we started, you know, putting them into the schools. We had been working with them, we had been training teachers, so we were just assuming that everyone was on, because we were on board, we thought everyone was on board. We obviously have found out differently. One of the things that we have found, though, that the questions that come to us are about it's how a teacher is teaching something.
Right.
Not about the standard.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for your time this evening. It was great to have you.
Ashton, it was so great to be here, and we'd love to come back.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the House today.
Among the bills introduced in the House today, House Bill 2202, to provide a more equitable disbursement of funds to county school boards to lessen the budgetary impact of serving special needs students. The bill eliminates the requirement of annual review of rules, policies, standards, federal law, and reports. House Bill 2203, to amend the provisions of the current code to human trafficking to allow for charges to be brought and associated remedies are available when even a single individual is exploited and victimized by sex or labor trafficking. This bill was recommended for passage by the House Select Committee on Crimes Against Children. House Bill 2206, to repeal requirements to pay prevailing wages for construction of public improvements. House Bill 2207, to set guidelines that the West Virginia Commissioner of Highways must follow in establishing the list of priorities for the construction, reconstruction, repair, and maintenance of state roads and highways. House Bill 2208, to ensure that only government officials elected by voters to serve on a county commission will have the power to regulate smoking. House Bill 2216, to authorize only the legislature can create state-based health exchanges for health insurance. House Bill 2218, to create the Budget Reform Act. The bill requires a 1% spending cut per year for 10 years and reduction in the size of state government. House Bill 2237, to prohibit labor agreements on state-funded construction projects. House Bill 2238, to require that the governor's appointees to the Public Service Commission be from each of the three U.S. congressional districts. House Bill 2239, creating the Board of Health Professions to consolidate current boards for each medical discipline. Up for passage in the House tomorrow, House Bill 2025, prohibiting certain sex offenders from loitering within 1,000 feet of a school or child care facility. And House Bill 2201, requiring the Public Service Commission to adopt certain net metering and interconnection rules and standards. Net metering means measuring the difference between electricity supplied by an electric utility and electricity generated from a facility owned or operated by a retail customer.
State Treasurer John Perdue presented his office's proposed budget before the Senate Finance Committee this morning. Like so many other state agencies, his office is once again undergoing cuts. Treasurer Perdue told committee members the governor's proposed budget for fiscal year 2016 includes a 5% cut for his office, bringing the total cuts they've endured over the past 3 years to nearly 20%. That's resulted over time in the consolidation of some divisions and this year, the loss of two full-time positions. The treasurer's office has returned some $90 million from the state unclaimed property fund since 1997 to help balance the budget. Perdue says the governor's 2016 budget includes another $15 million transfer from that account in July, but he says that's a problem. The industry standard is for the state to maintain 10% of their total outstanding liabilities within the unclaimed properties account, but that 10% won't exist if the additional money is taken.
This is the people's money. This is not taxpayers' dollars. This is loved ones' money that is in a fund that is the people's money of the state. And yes, we can borrow from that. It's like a rainy day fund. We can borrow from that and take that money, but sooner or later, it's got to be paid back.
In the end, Perdue says the transfers would leave him with just $6 million in his unclaimed property account. To meet the industry standard and have enough money left to cover operating costs, he needs at least $24 million in that fund. Without it, those claiming their funds will see slower returns. Senator John Unger of Berkeley County says he's not comfortable with the governor's proposal.
I think it's a dangerous precedent that we start balancing our budget off of that account when it really isn't taxpayers' money. And if we do start doing that, I would submit that's probably one could argue that's an additional tax on the people. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you don't claim your account in the bank and it's transferred over to you, and that money is rightfully the owner of that property, we're starting to rob that account and it inhibits you in your operations and trying to get it back to those people, the rightful owners of that money in the first place, or that property. And by robbing that account and taking it down to $6 million inhibits that significantly, and therefore, I think does a disservice to the people of West Virginia.
Senator Bill Laird of Fayette County shared in his worry, saying the state should be held to a higher standard when returning unclaimed monies. Finance Committee Chair Senator Mike Hall says he plans to continue discussing the issue with the treasurer in the hopes of finding a way to make sure the program still works while keeping in mind that it is a tight budget year.
Two West Virginia advocacy groups gathered outside the House of Delegates this morning to protest a bill they say is unconstitutional. Lawmakers in the chamber have reintroduced the 20-week pain-capable Unborn Child Protection Act this year with additional provisions.
The Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act makes it illegal for a medical professional in the state to conduct an abortion after 20 weeks, except when the mother has a medical emergency. It also sets up civil and criminal penalties for doctors who do not comply with the ban. The bill was passed by both the House and Senate during the 2014 legislative session, but vetoed by the governor because he questioned its legal standing. Margaret Chapman Pomponio is the executive director of West Virginia Freedom for Reproductive Education and Equality, also known as West Virginia Free. She says such a ban is dangerous for women.
It takes health care decision making out of the hands of women and their trusted providers and puts it into the hands of government. The legislature, frankly, isn't in a position. They don't have the knowledge to make these kinds of decisions.
Jennifer Meinig with the West Virginia American Civil Liberties Union says this year's version of the bill is much more extreme than the version approved by lawmakers last year.
The 20-week ban as introduced is unconstitutional. Every court in the country that's addressed this issue has found bans like this to be unconstitutional, and this bill is no different.
The bill also creates a litigation fund, essentially a pool of money for the Attorney General's office to help pay for legal proceedings that may come if the bill is passed and enacted. The bill has been sent to the House Health and Human Resources Committee for consideration. A similar piece of legislation was introduced in the Senate earlier this week.
This has been the legislature today. Tomorrow, we'll close out the first full week of this legislative session by talking with two reporters who are also covering the legislature. Joining us will be Mandy Cardosi, State House reporter for the State Journal, and Jonathan Matice, the State House reporter for the Associated Press. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The High Technology Foundation, headquartered at the I-79 Technology Park in Fairmont. Online at wvhtf.org.